Welcome back to Upfront. I'm Rochelle Carey. Today, I'll talk to the journalist who was suspended from the U.S. sports network ESPN for her outspoken political views, including calling Donald Trump a white supremacist. I'll ask her how she feels now that the U.S. president has refused on live television to condemn white supremacy. This week's headliner, Jemele Hill. Jemele Hill, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront. I'm going to take you back to 2017, right? You were at the center of a national firestorm because you tweeted that Donald Trump, the president of the United States, was a white supremacist, right? So White House press secretary said you should be fired. Your employer, ESPN, rebuked you. You did not back down. You went even further. You eventually tweeted some political things about a very popular owner of an American football team. At that point, ESPN said enough and they suspended you. What was that like that, you know, you're getting all of these attacks from the president himself, from the White House? What was that like?
It was a little crazy because I'll be totally honest. I thought me tweeting that Donald Trump was a white supremacist was essentially telling you water was wet. Like, I thought we kind of all agreed that this was the case, particularly after Charlottesville. And he made the remark about very fine people being on both sides, equating white supremacists to people fighting against white supremacy and racism. And so, believe it or not, I actually didn't expect to get in trouble for that at all. And I think maybe sometimes ignorance is bliss. Had I thought about what might be the possible ramifications, sure, I may not have tweeted it. But, you know, nevertheless, I'm glad that I did, although I'm not pleased the fact that I was right.
Just a few weeks ago in the first presidential debate, Donald Trump walked away from the opportunity, the challenge to tell white supremacists to back down. He did not. So since this time in these last 3 years, there have been many other people that have called President Donald Trump a white supremacist. Do you feel validated in some way?
I actually don't. I have the opposite feeling. I feel, frankly, very sad about this and kind of heartbroken because I didn't want to be right about this. I wished I was dead wrong. I wish that what I said that a few years, you know, now we're looking in hindsight, that in 2020 we'd be saying, like, look how wrong that prediction was. Look how wrong you were, and you unjustly attacked this man, and he turned out to be everything different from what you said. But unfortunately, he's only proven me more right every single day, and more people have seen it. I mean, America does not deserve to have a white supremacist president. They don't. I mean, we don't. I mean, I live in this country, too. I have to live under his authority. So, no, I don't feel validation at all. I feel just sad and heartbroken, as I said. And it's unfortunate that the American people are put in this position to have to be subjected to this kind of language that he uses on a frequent basis. And to know that we have a president that struggles to denounce something as basic and as awful and evil as white supremacy.
Do you find it ironic that this White House attacked you for your use of words when this is a White House that has called people animals? They have told three American congresswomen of color to go back to where they came from. How do you reconcile the fact that they're mad at you about words you use, but they use really harsh rhetoric against people all the time?
Unfortunately, with this administration, this is just how they operate. This is how they do business, is that they want to police and cancel everybody else, but they're forever lecturing people about the awfulness of cancel culture and about how they speak to each other. To refer to vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris as a monster, or not even a monster, this monster, as if she's a dehumanized thing. To call Maxine Waters, the other congresswoman, to question her IQ. It seems like with women of color, he keeps coming back to certain tropes that are racist and unacceptable. And it exposes further just how he really feels about people. I mean, if he's saying this about women who are in a position of authority and leadership, what is he saying about the average Black person that he comes in contact with, if there is one? It just is a scary notion to contemplate.
Since you left ESPN, it seems that many of the on-air talent are much more outspoken in the social media realm, on air. saying things that are similar to what you said. Is that correct? I mean, are we right that it seems that the environment has changed there and that ESPN is not just sticking to sports, as some people say?
No, I think your assessment is accurate. I mean, they're talking about social justice issues frequently, if not, you know, frequently may not even be the word. I think it's probably daily. And when you're in sports, it's almost your job to distract people from some of the things that are happening in current events and some of the atrocities and going through a pandemic. Like, it's your job to provide a sense of relief to the audience that is watching you. But it gets hard for you to manage because there were days, certainly after Donald Trump was elected and after Charlottesville and after a number of other incidents, where I went into work and I just didn't feel like talking about who was going to win the AFC East. Like, I just didn't care because I am being subjected to all these other things that are happening. I mean, yes, I'm a journalist, and yes, I work at ESPN, but I'm also a Black woman in America, and that is coming before all of those other things. And so I'm just happy that my colleagues are able to discuss these issues openly, hopefully without fear of retribution or being, you know, policed internally.
Is there the difference that there needs to be more diversity in the newsroom so that you feel like you can say what you need to say without fear of retribution, without being accused of having a bias because of your race?
I think ESPN has the same blind spot in issues that a lot of media outlets have. Still overwhelmingly white, still a lot of people making the content decisions are white. And because of that, there is a lack of sensibility that is there. It's not just about diversity, it's about inclusion too. So that there is not, you know, I couldn't help but notice that a lot of these companies were putting out these very flowery, pretty statements about racial inclusion and suddenly saying Black Lives Matter when they considered it a curse word 4 years ago. That's all great, that's good. However, what does your organizational chart look like? If your organizational chart does not reflect those pretty statements you were putting out, then you got some work to do. And hopefully this moment has made a lot of these decision makers and corporations understand that they have got to get serious about disrupting, dismantling, and changing the inside of their organization.
Let me ask you about that specifically, what you're talking about, that now, you know, it's fine to have all these messages, these social justice messages at all the leagues, not just the NBA, and we're going to come back to the NBA, but all the leagues, including the NFL. But the NFL is also the same league where Colin Kaepernick, who was formerly a star quarterback, does not have a job, has not had a job since 2016 when he chose to kneel during the national anthem as a protest against racial injustice and police brutality. How do you reconcile the fact that the NFL now, you know, kind of gives a green light to their players to talk about social justice, but Colin Kaepernick still doesn't have a job? Is it a type of performative activism?
Definitely, you can't reconcile it because no matter what they do, no matter what they say, they will not be able to atone for that injustice. As long as he doesn't have a job in the NFL, and I doubt he ever gets one, they won't be able to be taken seriously, at least not by me. I can't speak for everybody, obviously, but I consider what they're doing to be performative, as you said. They're doing this because this is where the country's sensibilities are. The only thing that changed between now and last NFL season is that public opinion shifted. What changed was George Floyd. What changed was Ahmaud Arbery. What changed was Breonna Taylor, in that they were no longer able to escape what was happening in this country, and the players were demanding to be heard. But Colin Kaepernick was their glowing example about what can happen to you when you speak out a little too much, when you make too many people a little bit too uncomfortable. And it's not just Colin Kaepernick either that they have to atone for. If you're putting out these statements about Black Lives Matter and that you're listening, what's happening inside your organization? Right now, we have a situation where there are two Black general managers in the NFL. They do not have a majority Black owner, and they've never had one. They have one Black team president, first one in NFL history. They have three Black head coaches. These are embarrassing statistics. You can't talk about white supremacy or Black Lives Matter when they don't even matter in your own league. So as far as I'm concerned, all of what the NFL is doing, while I guess it's well-intentioned, it's also something I can't take very seriously because their actions have spoken way too loud for me to actually pay attention to their words.
Okay, let's talk about the election. Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee, obviously. You had some critiques, some criticisms of him during the Democratic primaries. You said that at least some of his support was rooted in, and this is a quote, fear that white folks won't vote for anyone else on that stage. Of course, a reference to the fact that there were an extremely diverse array of Democratic candidates. You're also critical of the 1994 crime bill, of which he played a large part in, which incarcerated millions of African Americans. He won the Democratic nomination. So how do you reconcile those criticisms you had with you now supporting him?
So the reason I think the primary is the appropriate time where you bring up all the issues you have with any potential presidential nominee. But Joe Biden was able to get to the front of the line because we also have to remember that a lot of people, especially a lot of Black people who are very pragmatic voters, despite the fact that they keep getting painted as liberals, it meant something to them that Joe Biden was second in command to the first Black president, that he was there at the service of the first Black president. And I think I underestimated what that meant, particularly to older Black people who are such a reliable voting bloc in the Democratic Party.
So let me jump in just a second, because I want to get to that reliable voting block. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I think that's key. Because African Americans are a reliable voting bloc, does the Democratic Party owe them more?
Oh, no question about it. Because, look, me supporting Joe Biden is not my, completely blind support of the Democratic Party as a whole. I mean, I think they have done a huge disservice to Black voters. They're still doing a huge disservice to Black voters. This is not something that is past tense. However, agenda items that are specific for Black America, that will help Black America, will be respectfully and genuinely heard with Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I really do believe that. And so, you know, once the primary passed and me bringing up Joe Biden with the crime bill, by the way, that was in relationship to how I felt like it was really unfair that Kamala Harris was somehow being made the face of mass incarceration by a lot of people in our community when the dude that wrote the crime bill is right next to her on the same stage and not getting that same smoke.
And to your point, yes, she's a former prosecutor. She has been criticized by many on the left for being not tough enough on police and too tough on some defendants. Do you agree with that criticism? And I get your point. You're comparing and contrasting it to the way she got a criticism for her record, which is fair, but compared to the type of criticism that Joe Biden got.
You know, I will say this. I think it's fair to look at her record. The best word that I would come up with it is that I think she had some opportunities that she took advantage of while being attorney general and certainly while being a prosecutor. And there were some missed moments for sure. But this idea that Kamala Harris single-handedly locked up every Black man in jail is just wrong. And it's been debunked many times. And I just find it interesting that when she was debating against Mike Pence, that he wanted to point out her record of incarcerating Black men when he moments before that said that there was no systemic racism in the criminal justice system. So which one is it? Is it only systemic racism when it's a Black woman that just so happens to be at that point? I think she was the first Black attorney general in California's history. So you use it conveniently for that, but not, you know, when you actually have to address this issue within your own administration.
Let's talk about Kamala. That's going to be our final note, specifically a Black woman being on the ticket. Just what do you think that imagery means for Black boys and girls and white boys and girls?
I think it's really significant, but I'll focus for the moment on Black women because I am a Black woman, obviously. But I think what's significant about it, especially for us, is that without ever having had a conversation with Kamala Harris, and I've been fortunate enough to have a few with her, is that you already know what she went through to get there. And you know what that was like. And more importantly, what I like about seeing her on this ticket and why it's significant for me is that she makes no apologies for seizing her power. And a lot of times women, but in particular Black women, we are put in a position where we have to defend our ambition, defend us seizing our power. And she has always carried herself in a way that she's not going to apologize for being great. You know, when that idea surfaced that she wouldn't be the vice presidential nominee pick because she was too ambitious, it was really a conversation that had such broad implications. It's something that women face all the time, where our ambition is used against us. where it's not the case for men. Their ambition is highlighted, is considered to be a celebratory trait. So it's just significant to see her there for what it means, not just for Black women, not just what it means, you know, for multicultural women, period, not just what it means for historically Black colleges, and she's a proud graduate of Howard. But I think it embodies, much like it did with Barack Obama, the best of what this nation can be.
I like what you said about multicultural. We absolutely would be remiss if we did not acknowledge that her mother was an Indian American. You're absolutely right. And that's going to be the final note. Jemele Hill, thank you for joining us here on Upfront.
Always a pleasure. Thank you. Really appreciate the interview.
American voters are less than 2 weeks away from what could be the most important election of their lives. It's a decision that will profoundly alter not only life in the U.S., but also the lives of those around the world. For Palestinians especially, there's hope that if Trump loses, a Biden administration would reopen the door to a pathway to peace, or at least negotiations. But is Biden really that different from Trump when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? And does it even matter who is in the White House? Joining me to debate this are Alon Goldenberg, foreign policy and defense analyst and former chief of staff to the special envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations at the U.S. State Department, Rashid Khalidi, Edward Said professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University. He was also an advisor to the Palestinian delegation to the Madrid and Washington Arab-Israeli peace negotiations in the 1990s. Thank you both for joining me here in the arena. Appreciate it. Alon, I'm going to start with you. So just the other week, the Palestinian Prime Minister, Mohammed Shtayyeh, when talking about the upcoming U.S. election, said if things are going to change in the United States, I think this will reflect itself directly on the Palestinian-Israeli relationship, and it will reflect itself also on the bilateral Palestinian-American relationship. Alon, do you think the Prime Minister is right? Will anything actually change?
Yeah, well, I think yes. You know, maybe not as much as some people would like, but I think you are going to see a pretty significant change in that the Trump administration has really just entirely torn down the relationship with the Palestinians. They have basically, since the U.S. Decided to move the embassy to Jerusalem, there really hasn't been a relationship between the Palestinian Authority and the United States. And so I think what you'd expect to see is Biden's talked about, you know, reopening the PLO mission in Washington, reopening the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem that really acts as a embassy to the Palestinians, restarting assistance to UNRWA, restarting assistance to the Palestinians. I think all of those are improvements on where things have been for the past 4 years.
Rashid, do you agree?
Well, I think it'll be a mercy to not have to deal with the Trump administration anymore for all of us in the United States and elsewhere, certainly for Palestinians. The punitive, vindictive, nasty, narrow-minded tactics of that administration vis-a-vis the Palestinians really reached a new low. And those things will undoubtedly change, as has just been described. But I think that looking for fundamental change in the American approach is something that we're going to continue to have to do even after, if Vice President Biden is elected. The United States is going to have to completely change a lot of basic things if we're going to move towards peace and not towards another meaningless process. You have to have somebody say occupation is illegal and has to be ended unconditionally. You have to have somebody saying settlements are illegal and they will have to be removed. You have to have somebody saying the Palestinians have an absolute right to self-determination, irrespective of restrictive conditions that Israel might want to impose.
So, Alon, can you see the Biden administration, if there were one, to do any of those types of things? I mean, and is it really fair for anyone to label him an honest broker? Because specifically, I mean, he has said that he will not move the embassy back to Tel Aviv, even though he thought it was a bad move. He called it frivolous and short-sighted. He is a self-proclaimed Zionist. He has called the U.S.-Israeli relationship ironclad, and he's completely ruled out the possibility of withdrawing any type of aid from Israel to get them to change anything that they do. So the types of things that Rashid is talking about, is there a reason to think the Biden administration would entertain any of the things he just said?
I don't know. I don't speak for them. I would say, though, that my take is, look, I mean, the U.S. has had a long, strong relationship with Israel. I don't think you could expect that to fundamentally change. I'm not sure that the U.S. role in the peace process has ever been one of even broker. And I'm not sure that's exactly what even the Palestinian leadership wants. What the Palestinian leadership wants is an effective broker. And the idea is that the U.S. relationship with Israel helps it be an effective broker. Now, the reality is that's failed in the past. And just rather than going back into a meaningless process again, which I would actually advocate against, I don't think that the Israeli leadership as it is right now is ready for it. I don't think the Palestinian leadership as ready as it is right now. So instead, I would argue for trying to actually do meaningful, substantive things on the ground that improve freedom, prosperity, and security for everyone. And that does mean taking a hard line on settlements and trying to deter settlements. It means there are a lot of things it can do. And there's also things that Palestinians need to do in terms of their own governance, in terms of trying to get a unified government again in elections and a more responsive government. So there's so much that can be focused on, not just quote unquote economic peace, which has been tried before, but real steps on the ground, short of just rushing everybody back into a negotiation, that I think would be much more constructive.
Rashid, let's talk about the settlements a little bit more for a moment. Even in the midst of this coronavirus pandemic, Israel has continued to improve new settlements. Just this month, the Israeli government actually gave the green light to the construction of 2,500 new housing units. What are your thoughts? I assume you're skeptical to think that the Biden administration would do anything about that.
Well, I think you have to have a complete, not only a change in rhetoric, where settlements are described as illegal and where occupation is described as an unmitigated evil that has to be ended. I think you have to have a change in implementation. You're going to have some kind of sanctions. You're going to have some kind of pressure. You're going to have to tell the Israelis, American money cannot be used to build settlements. The United States won't protect you in the Security Council if you do this, that, and the other. And I would hope that an American administration would do this. These are things that the American people want. The building of settlements is something that takes place largely with American money, not government money, but money that's tax-free. The Biden administration could have the Treasury stop people who are building settlements from getting American tax-free dollars. So that, whether, is that sanctions on the Palestinians? No, I think that, in fact, the Palestinians are being sanctioned by the U.S. government by its allowing their land to be stolen and Israeli-only settlements built in their place with American tax-free dollars. So that's an example of, I would hope, the kind of thing that might happen. I really think that there are things that are that is possible to say in the American public space that you couldn't say 10 years ago. And I think that the Biden administration could, I don't know that it will, and I think what happened with the platform is an indication of the limits on their thinking. There are things that they could do, which I would hope they will. I'm not sure that they will, however.
Okay, so we've had this discussion about what could change or will or won't change, be it a Biden administration or a Trump administration. But at the end of the day, does it really matter? Aren't there just entrenched issues that are more about U.S. institutions, regardless of who actually ends up in the White House? Ilan, your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think what matters more is that there's entrenched Israeli and Palestinian institutions and views. Yes, the U.S. has a role to play. We have traditionally been, you know, the central mediator. And actually, I would argue that our position has traditionally been to come in and just elbow everybody else out, right? I mean, like, that's kind of what we do. And rather than doing that, I think we need to be part of a process, but I think we do need to be more inclusive and bring in other international actors and other players who have an interest and a role. And so I think we can do all of that, but we also have, you know, two leaders in Bibi Netanyahu and Mahmoud Abbas, who are both incredibly risk-averse, who don't trust or like each other at all, who aren't going to work together. You have an Israeli politics that is moving increasingly to the right and has been stuck in like four separate elections over the past 2 years, or three or four, I lose count. You have Palestinian politics that is entirely divided, hasn't had an election in 15 years between Fatah and Hamas. So I think there are, and you have societies that are moving in opposite directions and increasingly don't even interact with each other. So look, there are definitely problems in American policy and things that the U.S. needs to fix and do better. But let's also be clear, they're like the biggest problems in both right now are with, you know, the leadership in Israel and the leadership in Palestine. Like, those are also huge problems. So you need to kind of, frankly, you need new leadership on all three sides if you're going to have any chance of making any progress at all.
So, Rashid, what about that? Ilan is making the point that he thinks there needs to be new leadership on pretty much all sides. But the question remains, you can move all these pieces. Do you think the issue is bigger than just that? Because some of these things are deeply systemic and entrenched in these institutions in all three groups.
No, I think that's a good point. I think that certainly in the United States, there are a set of attitudes among the foreign policy professionals who pay no attention to public opinion and who have a set of assumptions, some of which I think are false, and which are part of the problem, in my view. As Aaron David Miller said, the United States has acted as Israel's lawyer. I think that's a problem. I think that responding to a certain very vocal set of attitudes in American public opinion, which no longer, I think, represent what many Americans feel about Israel and the Palestinians, has led the United States to basically disqualify itself from acting as a mediator. And I certainly agree that there's a need for change in leadership on the Palestinian side. I mean, these people have been there, as Ilan said, since the 2006 election. Because of the dire nature of the current situation, the Palestinians are being forced to finally do the Palestinian factions that dominate the government in Ramallah and the administration in Gaza, are being forced to do what they should have long ago done, which is to try and come up with a common position to reunify the Palestinian national movement and figure out what their strategy is. And I fault the Palestinian leadership, or the lack of Palestinian leadership, and the lack of strategic vision among the Palestinian leadership for that. As far as Israel is concerned, yes, they obviously need new leadership, and sooner or later they're going to get it. I would guess that a change in the United States might precipitate that, but it might not.
Okay. Well, it all remains to be seen. Ilan Goldenberg, Rashid Khalidi, thank you both very much for this discussion. And that is our show. Upfront will be back next week.